Good afternoon. My name is Seth Garfield. I'm the director of the Institute for Historical Studies, and it's my pleasure to welcome you all today to our inaugural talk for the Institute's program theme this year on capital and commodities. We are very honored to have with us as our guest our colleague here at the University of Texas, James Galbraith, an internationally renowned expert in the field of economic inequality. James Galbraith holds the Lloyd M. Benson Jr. Chair of Government and Business Relations at the LBJ School at UT. He's the author, co-author, or editor of over a dozen books and the author of over 100 articles. His penultimate book, Inequality and Instability, A Study of the World Economy Just Before the Great Crisis, was published in 2012 by Oxford. Nobel laureate Joseph Stiglitz praised the work for pioneering new understandings of economic inequality and its implication for politics and society, leaving, quote, no stone unturned in its discussion of metrics and methodologies, unquote. His most recent book, The End of Normal, The Great Crisis and the Future of Growth, was published earlier this month by Free Press. Dr. Galbraith holds an undergraduate degree from Harvard and a PhD in economics from Yale. He served for nearly a decade on the U.S. congressional staff, including as executive director of the Joint Economic Committee between 1981 and 82. He's been the recipient of numerous honors, fellowships, and prizes, including a Marshall Scholarship to King's College, Cambridge, a Fulbright and Carnegie Fellowship, and the Robert Hamilton Book Award. He's the chair of Economists for Peace and Security and senior scholar at the Levy Economics Institute. In 2010, he was elected to the Accademia Nazionale dei Lincei. In 2012, he served as president of the Association for Evolutionary Economics. And this year, he was the co-winner of the Leontief Prize for Advancing the Frontiers of Economic Thought. In awarding the Leontief Prize, which recognizes economists whose works, like that of the Nobel laureate Leontief himself, combines theoretical and empirical research to promote a more comprehensive understanding of social and environmental processes, the committee noted, quote, for too long, many economists have viewed rising inequality as an inevitable consequence of economic development. The recent economic upheavals call for a new approach to understanding the causes and consequences of inequality. James Galbraith has shown that inequality isn't an outcome driven by factors outside of our control, but instead is often a direct result of the policy choices we make, unquote. Our responder today is Mark Metzler, professor of history and Asian studies at UT, as well as this year's program coordinator for the Institute. Professor Metzler received his BA from Stanford and his PhD in East Asian history from UC Berkeley. He's the author of two books, Lever of Empire, The International Gold Standard and the Crisis of Liberalism in Pre-War Japan, published by UC Press, which was the first book in English about the origins of the Great Depression of the 1930s in Japan. This book received the Hamilton Book Award. His second book, Capital as Will and Imagination, Schumpeter's Guide to the Post-War Japanese Miracle, published by Cornell, focused on post-war Japan as a case study for exploring the socially imagined nature of financial capital and its relationship to the deployment of labor and material resources. One of the broad implications of this book is that the financial system institutionalized during the 20th century now works to create financial bubbles and to concentrate wealth in ways that are both unjust and socially destructive. Please join me in welcoming Dr. James Galbraith.
Thanks very much, and perhaps I'd better stand just so my voice can carry to the far reaches of the room. Seth, Mark, Jeremy, David, Matt, Josh, colleagues, students, this is a pleasure and a privilege for me to be here with so many of my friends and to be the first speaker of this series, which promises, I think, to be just an exceptional event. I'm here to talk mainly about work other than my own. I entitled this talk, Up from Piketty, Capital and Inequality. And of course, the question that will be raised later on is, up, but yes, in what direction precisely? Toward what alternative? What are the grand dynamics that drive the accumulation and distribution of capital? This is the question that appears on the dust cover of Capital in the 21st Century by Thomas Piketty, which promises us also, clear guiding theory, and a unique collection of data to support that theory in pursuit of an answer to that question. The vast range, one might also say the great length, the literary allusions, and the intimidating array of fact, along with the expression, I think, of concern about a pressing social question whose importance really can't be denied, namely inequality, has apparently charmed many readers of Professor Piketty's book. I wasn't one of them. My early review appeared in Dissent. It actually was not one of the first reviews to appear, but it was perhaps one of the first, almost surely one of the first to be written because of the lags between writing and publication in the case of that journal, and also because the editor made me rewrite it at least once in order to appear less aggravated than I actually felt. But it was certainly a Dissent, and therefore published in the right place. And so in the general rush of adulation that swept over this book in the spring of last year, I was very much the skunk at the garden party. But I have to say, I have had the benefit of reading a great many things that have been written about capital in the 21st century. Since then, an enormous compilation done by Issa Oler Gradia over the course of the summer, and nothing that you discovered, Ilsa, has yet persuaded me to recant.
And that should surprise us.
Now, the word capital appears in bright red on the cover of this book, with the rest of the title relegated to fine print. And this has to be, and I think David Colander made this point in a piece I saw a few weeks ago, one of the greatest marketing judgments in the history of a university press. Mm-hmm. Certainly distinguishes the design and perhaps the success of the book in the United States from its rather humdrum appearance and reception in France. It, of course, serves the purpose of creating a frisson of association with Marx, and apparently suggests that that association still resonates in this very non-Marxian country. But I would suggest that the association and, in the text, the explicit challenge that Piketty makes to Marx also carries a burden, which is to be quite careful with the meaning of words. In economics, of course, I'm not sure about history, but in economics, the word capital is perhaps the most freighted word in the dictionary. So what is capital? For Marx, capital is almost unambiguously a concept tied to the emergence of social class. It is control over the means of production, and the capitalist class are the people who are vested with that control, who have the right of ownership. Capitalism is a system where that right has been stripped away from tool-owning and using artisans, the characteristic pattern of the feudal system, and separated from labor. Now, the tools are vested in one class and the labor in another. Joseph Schumpeter, certainly not a Marxist, but politically, but certainly also a very careful and adept and lucid student of Marx, makes this point at the beginning of the great 1942 book, Capitalism, Socialism, and Democracy, which devotes, I think, four chapters to various aspects of Marx's work. And on page 12, he writes, The forms or conditions of production are the fundamental determinant of social structures, which in turn breed attitudes, actions, and civilizations. Marx illustrates his meaning by the famous statement that the handmill creates feudal and the steam mill capitalist societies. Schumpeter goes on to say that stresses the technological element to a dangerous extent, but if you can accept it if you don't go too far down that road. And he goes on to note on the next page that this is not simply taxonomic category. Social classes are not the creatures of the classifying observer, but live entities that exist as such. Schumpeter's, I think, accurate description of the Marxian view. And of course, given that you have classes, given that there are two of them that predominate in the capitalist system, conflict is inevitable. There is an increasing organic composition of capital leading to crisis and ultimately to revolution. That's the essence of the Marxian scheme, drawing, of course, on Hegel, thesis, antithesis, synthesis. The question of the distribution of product, therefore income, in Marx, boils down to a straightforward matter of exploitation. All output is valued according to the quantity of labor input that goes into it, living and dead. The share going to capital is surplus value, and the proportion is the rate of exploitation, S over V. There is no necessary role here for adding up the stock of machines to arrive at an aggregate quantity, and no concept of national income of which the return on that quantity would be a share. Marx, in fact, his analysis predates those rather modern 20th century notions. It's Ricardo's scheme of value which holds here. That value arises in labor and is divided between those who reproduce the labor, who are given a wage determined socially and driven down in the process of class conflict to a minimum, and those who have the title to the output and who extract as much as they can get away with. Now, in the late 19th century, neoclassical economics arose to dispute, indeed to confound, this classical view in two ways. First, as against Marx, capital was now physical machinery rather than a social formation. It became a concept that applies to the productive stock, and that physical machinery was conceived of as operating in cooperation with labor, not in conflict. Dividing the output according to a schema which ultimately in the 20th century we came to know as marginal contributions or marginal productivity under certain specific mathematical conditions. And second, the neoclassical view of the world had another effect, which is not really against Marx but is directed against the other great influential and subversive figure of the late 19th century, Henry George, which is to say that it suppressed the concept of land and therefore of land rent in the analysis, and so you have a production function where output is a function of capital and labor. I often ask my students if they could go home to their workshops and produce something for me that only capital and labor bring it in. You know, they say, "What about materials?" I say, "That's forbidden." Robert Solow once quipped that if God had wanted three factors, he would have made it easier to draw three-dimensional diagrams. This brings to mind another comment that you'll find in the opening pages of Schumpeter, which is that to call for a guffaw is an excellent way of disposing of an uncomfortable truth. With the neoclassical production function, therefore, one gets the idea of aggregate capital, marginal product, the rate of return on capital, and the capital labor ratio K over L, as well as the capital output ratio K over Y. as indices of the technical choices that have been made. And if you pick up Piketty, Capital in the 21st Century, you find these concepts right there, used in the same way that they are used in the neoclassical formation. This, for me, was a clear signal of where Piketty's intellectual and ideological formation actually comes from, and so I typed him as an MIT neoclassical, which in fact, I think it's fair to say, he is. He very coyly identifies himself as having joined a faculty of a university somewhere near Boston, which used to be a euphemism for Harvard, but you know it's now apparently MIT just as well. This I think caused a good deal of shock and discomfort among some people with at least Marxian sensitivities, who wanted to believe him to be a truly radical figure. Of course, he's really nothing of the kind. Another thing that emerged very quickly from that, and it's evident in the text and in my review of it, from this identification that Piketty has with the MIT school, is that he falls victim to the difficulty of that framework, which is that there is no coherent physical aggregate measure of heterogeneous capital goods, and hence no coherent rate of return to be derived from those goods. That is the lesson of the Cambridge controversies, which the MIT school has spent about half a century trying desperately to forget, overlooked, and neglect. Piketty's treatment of this in a few pages is just egregious. He speaks of English economists who were offended by their colonial descendants trying to liberate themselves from the English dominance. Overlooks the fact that the main players in this were, in fact, people with names like Sraffa and Pasinetti, who are Italian, and that the great chronicler was Jeff Harcourt, who was Australian, not exactly an imperial figure. Never mind. But anyway, his orientation toward that particular controversy is a really strong indicator of his basic ideological stance. But he actually doesn't try to give us an aggregate physical capital stock. Instead, for Piketty, K is something else. It's almost post-physical. It is simply the market valuation of capital assets. And it depends entirely on the degree of marketization that happens to exist in a particular society. So if you look at the Soviet Union, there would be no capital stock in the Soviet Union by Piketty's measure, because there was no market and therefore no market valuation of the machinery. Even though the Soviet Union took 40% of its output by its own measures each year and put that into investment goods, right? Of no great productivity, perhaps, but nevertheless. K would have been zero. In Bolivia, the privatization of the water system, or in the UK, the privatization of the rail system, would have increased the capital output ratio in Piketty's measure without any physical change occurring whatsoever. The grand dynamics of Piketty's capitalism are strictly financial dynamics. They have no, so far as I can tell, physical counterparts to speak of. So we come to the question, which every reviewer has taken up, is the question of R and G, the rate of return on capital and the rate of growth. And Piketty's celebrated assertion that as a normal tendency of the system, R, the rate of return on capital, is greater than G, that this implies increasing shares of capital income in total income, world without end. Moreover, Piketty argues that R has been over history a relatively constant 4 to 5%, while G is variable and subject to large fluctuations. Let's pass over the fact that actually in his own data there is a significant exception to this rule, which is the entire 20th century. And just take that as a maintained hypothesis. Piketty is dealing in the long run. And in one case, he illustrates this by giving us a chart, it's on page 354, in which the data go all the way out to 2100. which I found really very interesting. I don't know what archive one gets data for 2100 from, you know, as I say, where he got those numbers, God only knows, and after Tomas goes to meet him, perhaps God will know better than he does now. But why is R in this framework a constant? I have a little piece which is coming out in the World Economic Review, may have already appeared, in fact, in which I go into this. This is part of the treatment that what Piketty calls the first fundamental law. R is a ratio of two variables. Thank you, Mark. R is equal to alpha divided by beta. Nice Greek letters. That's intended to intimidate you, I think, where alpha is equal to the ratio of profits to income, and beta is equal to the ratio of capital to income. Now, you will notice that that's a complex fraction with the same thing in the denominator in both places. Y is therefore totally unnecessary. R is simply equal to profits divided by the valuation of the capital stock in financial terms, market capitalization. Why would that be a relatively constant thing over time? That's absolutely straightforward. When profits are high, the stock market is booming and the capital stock has a high valuation. When profits are low, the stock market tends to be depressed and the capital stock tends to have a low valuation. The ratio is therefore less volatile than either of the elements. No big deal, nothing surprising, nothing even terribly interesting. Of course, that's not true all the time. You can get bubbles, you can get changes in the discount rate. Privatization of the rails can give you a bigger K relative to the profit flow. But, you know, as a rule, the stability of it should not come as any kind of surprise. It has nothing, of course, to do with anything relating to physical productivity. But then the next question comes up, which is, let us accept that R is greater than G as a normal condition. Does this necessarily imply that there is a tendency of the system to become ever more unequal? Well, only if you're working in a world where R, the pure rate of return, is what actually becomes accumulated. But in the actual world, and especially in the 20th century, you know, there's some reservations to that rule. The first one is called taxation, which may not have been an important force on capital incomes in the 19th century, but in the 20th century, I suppose it runs about 30%. We could allow 20% since the advent of George W. Bush, Ronald Reagan before him, but 20% is still a reasonable withdrawal from that flow of capital income. And the second problem is that people who earn capital income don't save it all. There is something called capitalist consumption. Consumption plutonomy, as the marketers from the Citigroup, the economists, have come to call it, the consumption out of the wealthy of their capital gains. And if one then says, okay, what we really have here is, I'll just put it up here, R 1 minus T minus capitalist consumption, is that always going to be greater than G? Well, if R is 5%, sort of the upper end of Piketty's range, 1 minus 2.2 is the tax rate, minus maybe a couple of percent for capitalist consumption, we get 4 minus 2, which is equal to 2, which is pretty close to the long-run rate of growth. And the whole proposition that there's a natural tendency in a modern economy for increasing divergence becomes kind of ephemeral. There's no necessary reason to believe that that's the case. So what we have here is not grand dynamics, but basically an assertion which has been made fundamentally trivial by the simplifications with which it has been expressed. And so it's not surprising that the 20th century was an error, and that error does not depend, I mean an exception, does not depend, that exception does not depend on the thing that Piketty emphasizes, which is the destruction of physical capital in the world wars, something which didn't affect anything very much except maybe Belgium in the First World War, and only the major European contestants
in the Second World War and only to a limited extent, plus Japan. Of course, I'll come to that in a second. Okay. So, let's suppose we want to go up from Picketing. What particular direction should we take? I would suggest that it would not be a bad idea to start with Marx, capitalism as a social, capital as a social force, as interpreted by Schumpeter. Schumpeter's distinction from Marx was that he did not see capitalism as necessarily leading to systemic collapse and revolution. He saw it threatened by bureaucratic strangulation, but the entire achievement of capitalism, as Schumpeter famously says in a footnote to the Theory of Economic Development, is not in silk stockings for queens, but in making them available to factory girls of forever decreasing amounts of effort, excuse the politically incorrect image. Well, and then if we want to ask, where can we see the Schumpeterian impulse at work in modern economic history, I would suggest there's no better place to go than Japan, and no better guide to the Japanese experience than a book that was recently published entitled Capital as Will and Imagination by one Professor Metzler, E.C. Faison.
Thanks for the plug.
And I, you know, I read Marx's book and almost immediately fell in love with it because it captured for me something that I had been explained to me personally by one of the great architects of the Japanese post-war economic miracle, namely Tsuru Chigeto, Chigeto Tsuru, a figure who I encountered personally in 1981 when by some extraordinary happenstance, the Reagan administration sent me to Japan to lecture on supply-side economics. That's too funny a story. But I went to see him at the Nihon Keizai Shimbun, where he's a columnist. And he gave me a couple of metaphors that stuck in my mind to describe the way in which Japanese policy worked. One was building the mountain shelter. And the idea there is that the function of the government is to create safe zones so that the mountain climbers can go up with lighter equipment than they would otherwise require, climb faster, climb farther, more successfully. And the second one was walking in the wheat nursery, which has to do with the idea that you trample some of the seedlings in order that the others will grow more strongly. These two things, providing the forms of guidance of a qualitative character, were at that moment the vision of the Japanese strategy that Shigeto Tsuru conveyed to me. Now, who was Shigeto Tsuru? Well, he was a graduate student at Harvard in the early 1940s. He was a student of Schumpeter's. And he was someone who saw, as I think anybody of real perception could see, that Japan was not going to win this war, but who also had both the wit and the courage to understand that if he wanted to play a role in the Japanese reconstruction, he had to be there at the defeat. So he took repatriation, slow boat around the South Africa, and went to work in the foreign ministry. My understanding is, and this comes from another professor, and I've never seen it written up, but that in the summer of 1945, the foreign ministry needed a communist, and they only had one working for them, and that was Shigeto Tsuru. So they sent him to Moscow with the terms of surrender. And he was not obviously received either by the Soviets or by us because we had other plans. Right? So he was back in Japan when the bombs dropped and the surrender happened. I'll pick up the story just very briefly with a couple of little, since this is a history seminar, a little historical elements. These really don't deal with Shigeto directly, but he's present here. A letter, October 25th, 1945, from my father to my mother. My father had arrived in Japan the previous day from Saipan on a B-17 as the director of the Strategic Bombing Survey. My impressions of Japan, as you might suppose, are preliminary, but I can understand how a certain sentiment could develop for giving it back to the Japanese. I was prepared to find it primitive, but hardly that primitive, or rather, I was unprepared to find such a bizarre combination of good and bad, modern and primitive. The people are unbelievably poor, shabby, and distressed. The women wear not very clean kimonos and mount a huge cargo on their back, a baby and sundry other freight. I had supposed that the houses had a certain petite elegance, that instead they are mostly just miserable shacks with no more architectural appeal than your mother's garage. There isn't very much of Tokyo left, and it is my offhand impression that the Japanese will live not to regret it. A smallish area around the palace wasn't bombed except by accident, and that is where we are. The rest has almost all been burned. Not much high explosive was used on Tokyo, and because the city was mostly wood and the like, it burned to the ground. There were just vast open places littered with scrap iron and old radiators. No great heaps of rubble as in Germany. Next week, I'm going to spend my time interrogating Japanese bigwigs, including Prince Konoya and Tojo. And toward the end of the week, I'm going to Kyoto and Nagoya. Baran, that's Paul Baran, the great Marxist economist, and one of the worst soldiers in the history of the United States Army, I'm pleased to say. My father said, that, I remember him saying this, that this was a man who never shined his shoes, never tucked in his shirt, and never saluted an officer unless he was standing next to him at the urinals. Anyway, Baran and I are going together, and we are taking as our guide Shigeto, a very fine chap who used to be at Harvard and whom you may remember. He was a great friend of Paul Sweezy's and has some not very fine job in the Foreign Office. I won't read the second letter, but it's here, and I'll read it quickly. It doesn't say much, anything, but this, in honor of my new colleague, Josh Eisenman, I do want to read the postscript to this letter, which is simply, everything in this country is just fantastically too short. All right. I've already described the meeting that we had in 1981. 20 years before that, Shigeto wanted to come to the United States to pay a visit to Harvard and friends, see friends, and he was barred because of the McCarran Act as a communist. So my father, in one of his characteristically deft maneuvers, arranged for Harvard to give him an honorary degree and then got Bobby Kennedy to waive the McCarran Act on the grounds of a special exception for Harvard honorary degree recipients. I just recommend that to you as a strategy when you have to deal with the United States government on something unpleasant. I saw him last in 1999 and took him to lunch at the Imperial Hotel, and he was in excellent shape, walking without a cane or a hearing aid. I think a figure who you will meet slightly as you read Mark's book, but whose importance, along with others of the same philosophical bent, in framing the role of capital as will and imagination, and therefore is the vector of social change, comes across, I think, very strongly in that book. So I will just close by saying that on this issue, Metzler gets it right. Not approximately right, not right in a simplified way, but exactly right. And I think that you will see, you can use that framework to interpret the last great wave of business development in this country, the information technology boom, and you can use it to ask the question, what do we do now, in a way which is much more illuminating than, let's say, some of the alternatives which I took far too much time discussing earlier during this talk. Thanks very much.
Well, Thank you for the exaggerated phrase. I'll try to return a little bit. Avoid talking about my own book to try to talk about yours a little bit. I'll also try to keep it brief because I think people have a lot of questions, and maybe I just would like to introduce some of the points that come out in this new book. I just picked this up at the bookstore. It had just arrived actually on Friday, The End of Normal. And I'd like to talk about this word normal a little bit because I think it connects us to history, and it all brings some connection between what you're talking about here and what Piketty is talking about in his book. We're actually, notwithstanding your criticisms of him, I think there's certain points on which you may be in agreement here. Maybe one of the first points to make, or maybe before talking about that, I'd also just like to raise a question. If there's some time, I wonder if you would like to talk a little bit about the inequality project that you've been leading at the at the University of Texas. One of the impressions that you'll get, there is a little bit of self-marketing in Thomas Piketty's book, and you'll get the impression that that he somewhat was the one that discovered this question and was the one that really sort of applied a rigorous statistical methodology to it, and that's not quite the case. So maybe you could talk a little bit more about that. I think it would be interesting for all of us. There's a lot of historical work in there. I did find Piketty's book very attractive for all the graphs, I have to say, compared to, notwithstanding his neoclassical economic approach. He actually presents real time series data in his graphs rather than, as so many economists do nowadays, just graphs in which they depict the result of their models, and neither axis seems to represent anything real in so many of those graphs. So there's a lot of commonsensical, readily understandable material there, and I think that's one reason for the very positive reception of it, and timing and all kinds of other things. But on this question of normal, this book, James Galbraith's End of Normal is subtitled The Great Crisis and the Future of Growth. And there's all these questions swirling around that's very present in Piketty also. Are we entering a new, if not post-growth era, then a very low-growth era? Perhaps you're in agreement about that, perhaps not. I think you interpret the implications of that differently, but it seems to me that that you and he are both sharing a vision there, and it's a vision that I think we're starting to find in all kinds of connections, from ecological perspectives, most recently from economic perspectives, but for maybe reasons that everybody here is familiar with, or that most people are familiar with. For Piketty, I would say normal is the 19th century. He seems to continually come back to the 19th century as a kind of normal, and emphasizes the abnormality of the post-war period, of this very high-growth period that followed World War II, the two or three decades, maybe three decades after World War II. Maybe he overstresses that, but you may be in agreement about that also, and I'll just I wanted to jump to a quotation from the end of The End of Normal, where you say that for you this book is a departure from the optimistic Keynesianism that you've expressed in the past. And I'd like to ask about that, about this departure from an optimistic Keynesianism. If I bring back Japan for just a moment, it's a little bit similar to a conclusion that I've come to also. As the Japanese slump, as it's described, went on and on and on, the idea that this is something that could be remedied by conventional Keynesian means became less and less and less plausible, in part because the Japanese government attempted one of the most radical Keynesian-style stimulus policies in history, and barely kept the economy out of negative growth territory. So something new seems to be going on here. And the suggestion from so many directions is that it has to do, among other things, with demography. That's particularly clear in Japan, where we're actually into an era, have been for the last several years, of actual declining national population. Japan's been a pioneer country in that way. But in Europe as well, I think the standpoint that Thomas Piketty is taking is very much has that demographic reality in the background, with France being actually one of the countries that's growing a little bit, as opposed to countries that aren't growing at all. One of the things that you also say there is that a new economics must rest on a biophysical and institutional framework. And those two things, both biophysical and institutional, I would really be interested in unpacking there. When we say biophysical, I think we're getting much closer to resource visions and ecological visions of things. Institutional sounds also like the approach of Shigeto Tsuru, and he's very much of an institutional economist, I think, and very much opposed to the standard sort of neoclassical approach to economics. So where the simple Keynesian answer to the crisis that we've been facing in this country since 2008, more demand, more growth, will that even work, is the first question, and is that even desirable in the form that growth has been taken is another question. Maybe I want to leave room for discussion, so I just wanted to raise maybe one more point that was a very striking way that you closed this book also. There's so many more things to say about this. We could talk about the role of banks, which might be one way to explore some of the weaknesses in Piketty's definition of capital, this very financial definition, but somehow a very orthodox reading of what it is that banks do as merely being financial intermediaries. It's a very, very, I would say, orthodox and just very, very implausible way of looking at things. But this parable that you close your book with of the collapse of the Soviet Union, this is an extended parable that goes on for several pages. And the reader knows it's coming, at least I think probably most readers can see it coming by the time they've got to that point in the book. The comparison with the United States and with the institutional rigidities and the institutional giantism that's emerged in this country, and maybe other people have things to say about that. I know probably not very many people in the audience have had a chance to look at that yet, but if you would like to talk more about those particular comparisons and especially about this departure from a Keynesian world, if that's what it is, I think that would be really valuable for us.
Okay. Just a few quick points. The departure from optimism is informed to some degree by the Japanese experience, but also just observation of what is politically and institutionally possible in the American context. I would love to agree with Paul Krugman. I was on a panel with him just a few days ago. That if we only did more stimulus, more spending, poured more fuel into the engine, that the car would then go. But I think when you've had a transmission meltdown, that's not a sufficient remedy. And that's the sort of the basic, at a metaphorical level, the basic difference between myself and Paul. I think that we face, and I deal with this in the book, we face a number of circumstances that really set us apart from the 1930s. One is that the resource environment, give or take natural gas, is really very different. Secondly, the world security environment is very different from what it was in the post-World War II period or in the immediate post-Cold War period. It's much more uncertain and unstable. Thirdly, has to do with the character of technical change.
it was one thing to move to mechanical transport and to bring a lot of activities from the growing of food to a lot of household labor that had been previously outside the market into the market. We now have these devices which are taking a lot of things that were previously in the market and removing them from the market, giving you essentially zero marginal cost for a lot of activity, but also no income to be derived from it. And if you're a journalist, that's not something which is at all mysterious or remote. May even reach professors sooner or later, so get your tenure now and hang on to it. And then the fourth thing is the nature of the financial system, which I think one can fairly say 2000 was the last great business investment boom. The decade and a half we've seen since then was a series of stopgaps and debacles, especially in housing finance. It's very different qualitatively, and unlike there's no since the crash, there's really no sign that the banking sector, the financial sector, has been rebuilt in order to provide the foundation of either construction or business employment activity that was the case before. Okay, those are the reasons for the departure from optimism. Institutional framework that would make a spending initiative successful in an easy way just doesn't exist. And that's quite an addition to that, you have the downsizing and the decapacitizing of the government itself. Demography, I am less of an advocate of demographic determinism than Piketty or than you might be from the Japanese experience. I think if you provide, first of all, the rising number of old people is a success, not a failure. It suggests that people are living longer. One reason they're living longer is that they're being paid to live longer by retirement systems and Social Security. This is a great success of supply-side economics. Give people a monetary incentive to stay alive, and by God, they continue to go out and buy food and feed themselves with it. You know, I cannot see what's wrong with this. But it does suggest that what you have to do, I can see the gray heads around the room expressing agreement. It shows that you know where your self-interest is. The problem here is that we may not actually continue to sustain those that part of the population, and if we impoverish them, we impoverish everybody. On the other hand, the resource question really, it clearly differentiates the relatively stable from the relatively unstable from the disastrous. The catastrophe in Japan, Fukushima and so forth, is a resource issue, greatly rising the cost of running the Japanese engine, right? The difference between Europe and the United States at the moment is natural gas. It's the difference between $3 and $13. Right? Which is, it's not the only fuel out there, but this is a very substantial difference, and it makes a big difference to manufacturing and the general stability of American society and the health and welfare of the state of Texas. I greatly commend Governor Perry for having the foresight to be the governor of a state that sits on a large pile of shale. It's a, very sensible of him. That gets to the biophysical question, right? Which has to do with the relationship between the cost of resources and the scale of activity that is locked in by fixed features. Nothing is fixed in the very long term, but things are fixed well enough in the medium term that you can't escape from them. And that gets that translates onto the other two questions, which I'll just pass over very quickly, but the banking system is a very large, very costly fixed feature of the American scene right now. Large, concentrated power in huge institutions that do what exactly? Have you tried to get a loan from one lately? Or talk to friends who have? There is a problem of the disconnect between public and private purpose here, which has not been resolved. In fact, quite the contrary. We've been led along the path of, and I don't think anybody believes it, but we're constantly told the savings of the banks was intended to save the economy. Well, that was half true. The banks are saved, the economy wasn't. In the case of the USSR, it was a very different set of fixed institutions, but
I was impressed at the time talking to people I knew who were Soviet reform economists, very people who were deeply involved in that system, who understood in the late 80s that the centralized machinery-driven system, which absorbed a huge fraction of output, was driving the system down, and the only way you could get out of it, as it in the end, was to abolish the Soviet system, right? The Soviet ministries. If they had figured out another way out, then they might have avoided some of the enormous disruptions that come from breaking up a large integrated entity and establishing international barriers and reconfiguring an industrial system that was designed, after all, to operate on a huge scale. It was the ultimate example of increasing returns and fixed cost as an effort to become efficient very fast, which in fact succeeded in the 30s and 40s, and then became out of date 30 or 40 years afterwards. So I think the basic principles here, which have to do with the scale of the system and the scale of fixed costs and the cost of resources and the burden of external obligations, are the same for all sorts of systems, provided very general framework, and one which was really overlooked in the development of neoclassical economics, which whose nature is that things are very quickly and smoothly substitutable. That's the flaw in the earlier, and still, in many cases, dominant logical framing of the production problem.
Okay, let's open this up for questions now. Jeremy?